You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Putz, coming to you from Washington, D.C.
And this is Ankit Panda, your co-host today. How's it going, Katie?
Going pretty good. How are you?
Doing good. Beautiful spring day here in Washington.
Finally. Well, you know, we have quite a treat for our listeners today. I'm going to be interviewing Ankit about his new book, which is cheerfully titled The New Nuclear Age at the Precipice of Armageddon. In Ankit's day job, when he isn't yammering on podcasts with me and others, Ankit is the Stanton Senior Fellow at the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So it's no surprise that he would write a book about the nuclear landscape, which has continued to evolve pretty dramatically, I would argue. But Ankit, let's start with that title because it intrigues me. You know, how do you define this new nuclear age? How is it different than earlier nuclear ages? You know, what really sets this era apart from, say, the Cold War, which I think listeners would probably view as the last most risky nuclear age we had?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Katie. I think you actually set it up really nicely. This book could have been called The Third Nuclear Age, but that's my publisher recommended against that because that's a little academic. You'd have to know what the first and second nuclear ages are before you might buy a book that alludes to a third nuclear age. So it's the new nuclear age broadly, but in the book I make the argument that we've been through two of these distinct periods in history since the arrival of nuclear weapons in 1945 at the end of the Second World War. The Cold War was the first era, right? This was the period when all of humanity is discovering what nuclear weapons are, what role they play in international politics, how they transform the entire enterprise of national defense, right? It's no longer about fighting and winning wars for the countries that have these weapons. It's about deterring wars more so than anything else, especially when your adversary also has nuclear weapons. And this is the era of bipolar superpower competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. Nuclear weapons balloon into the 70,000 range at the height of the Cold War. It's a very dangerous period. That word Armageddon in the title of my book really manifests, I think, in a very visceral way. The potential of Armageddon is very much looming over humanity during this time. Then the Cold War ends, and we enter what analysts and scholars generally agree was a second nuclear age. This was the period when nuclear dangers receded in a pretty big way because we weren't worried about a major exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union with thousands of nuclear weapons as much anymore. But there were new concerns, proliferation in South Asia when India and Pakistan went nuclear, proliferation on the Korean Peninsula. But this was also a time of relative optimism. Arms control continued to advance. We built a global nuclear order and rendered it more permanent. The Non-Proliferation Treaty was extended indefinitely in 1995. There was a test ban treaty in 1996 that opened for signature. And the book basically argues that starting roughly in the 2020s, and you could maybe make the argument that maybe things started a little bit earlier, maybe in the late 2010s, something shifted. Things became a lot more dangerous for reasons of geopolitics, technological change, domestic politics in the United States and elsewhere, the pull of nuclear proliferation, the global nuclear order becoming a lot more precarious. So the book describes why things have changed, what the meaning of these changes will be over the coming decades, and it closes with a set of thoughts about what we can actually do about it.
All right. Well, we will get to that last thought, but I do want to do a little bit of a survey, right? You mentioned sort of the height of the Cold War, 70,000 or so nuclear weapons in the world. What is the current standing of nuclear arsenals around the world? You know, who are the sort of major players in this? And, you know, what developments are you watching in this particular space in terms of who has nuclear weapons and who is looking to develop nuclear weapons?
Yeah, so, you know, we're in a world today where there's about 12,500 nuclear weapons, the vast majority still with the United States and Russia. Of course, the big story in Asia and really for the global nuclear order is China, all right? China, for the longest time, as late as 2019, was unusual, right? As a country of 1.4 billion people with tremendous growth in its national resources and its military aspirations, Chinese leader Xi Jinping had called for a world-class military for a while. But in 2019, the U.S. Intelligence community certified that China had around a nuclear arsenal numbering warheads in the low 200s, right? A fraction of the 4,000 plus that the United States has in its total stockpile, for instance. And then something changed. China started growing, so China is now estimated to be pursuing a nuclear buildup to about 1,500 warheads by the mid-2030s. Now, still below where the United States is, but that's a pretty big change. Then you have, of course, six other countries. You have France and the UK, France with roughly 290-ish, the UK with around 230-ish nuclear weapons, India and Pakistan and North Korea, and then Israel, the four nuclear possessor countries that are outside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So that's who's got them. But of course, you know, this is an Asia geopolitics podcast, and you know, you'll note that many of these countries are in Asia or carry out military operations in Asia, as the United States does. And an observation I make at the start of the book is that the global center of gravity, when it comes to nuclear weapons issues, has moved from, you know, the North Atlantic and the Euro-Atlantic, I would argue, today squarely to East Asia, where even if we are worried about nuclear risks over Ukraine between the United States, NATO, and Russia, the nuclear dangers and particularly the complexity that exists in Asia today is just really, really important to understand, right? Because you have North Korea becoming a lot more capable. You have India and Pakistan not just you know, entering into crises with them, which, by the way, just in the last 24 hours, we are looking at a new brewing crisis between India and Pakistan. Just for listeners, I guess we should say we're having this conversation on April 23rd, after a major terrorist attack in Kashmir. But it's not just India and Pakistan as a two-way game. The Indians are also concerned about China, so on and so forth. So Asia is a really big part of the story I tell in the book. And so, you know, for listeners on the podcast, I hope that they take an interest in the book just because, you know, Asia is a really big part of the story in this new nuclear age.
Great. Just to stick on East Asia for a minute more, you know, we over the last couple of years, I think in particular, since the first Donald Trump administration in the United States, there has been increased conversation, at least in South Korea in particular, but Japan also at times, about the possibility of these countries sort of developing their own nuclear weapons, on the idea that the U.S. nuclear umbrella is not quite as protective as they once believed. What do you think about those conversations? Is that something that just sort of analysts sort of kick around, or is that something that really exists in the realm of possibility in your mind?
Yeah, so I mean, the conversations are definitely real. There's definitely more interest in nuclear proliferation, not just in Asia, but also in Europe. This, you know, this class of problem, allied proliferation, proliferation by American allies, was something the U.S. thought about all the time during the Cold War, when South Korea tried to go nuclear in the 1970s, and the U.S. pressured them not to. Taiwan tried to go nuclear, and the U.S. Pressured them not to. Right? The U.S. has this. Or had, arguably, because we don't know where the Trump administration might go. But in the 1960s, the United States came to a realization that a world in which there were more countries with their fingers on the proverbial nuclear button, be those countries friendly or unfriendly to the United States, it didn't matter. That was just a more dangerous world, right? It meant that American influence in the world would be potentially more limited, that nuclear wars could begin that might implicate American interests. So the U.S. became, you know, the U.S. became really interested in preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. Now, the problem is twofold, right? So first, you have the Trump phenomenon, which is that Trump does not think about allies in the way that basically almost every president going back to Harry Truman thought about alliances, right? I mean, previous American leaders had differences about how they saw alliances and what they thought the United States should or shouldn't do, but we never really had a moment where you had an occupant of the White House that fundamentally saw allies as liabilities and thus demanded essentially tributary payments, essentially for American you know, defense guarantees. And so at the same time, you have threat perceptions that have risen in these countries, right? Japan and South Korea exist in a pretty dangerous neighborhood. You have North Korea, you have China, you have Russia, all nuclear-armed countries with varying degrees of geopolitical disagreement with South Korea and Japan. And so naturally, the pull factors are there. I do want to say, though, you know, South Korea and Japan are obviously very different from the domestic political angle here, because particularly when it comes to public opinion, Japan being the only country to have suffered nuclear attacks, there is a strong public neuralgia around the idea of acquiring nuclear weapons. It's still very much a taboo, even if Japanese public opinion has shifted on national defense in general. South Korea, very different picture. You know, consistently 60 to 70% of the public thinks that nuclear weapons acquisition would be a good idea.
Interesting, interesting. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. I do want to ask also about, you know, the status of the nuclear non-proliferation movement amid this sort of third nuclear age or new nuclear age. You know, this is obviously also a very heavily Asian influenced movement. You have the Pacific Islands are particularly interested in this, having been the site of many nuclear tests, but also Central Asia is very against proliferation, has its own non-proliferation zone. And so I'm interested in sort of how you view that movement at this movement at this moment, when you have sort of greater conversation around the possibility of nuclear weapons being deployed in conflict or by accident, who knows. So the non-proliferation, your thoughts?
Yeah, so, you know, non-proliferation and also nuclear disarmament, you know, continue to be a huge priority for many countries. The book talks about the tensions that have manifested between the non-proliferation treaty, which we talked about earlier, the NPT, and the newer treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, or the ban treaty, which has started to pick up a number of signatories, including signatories around Asia and the Pacific as well. Notably, no country that has nuclear weapons or is allied with a nuclear country has signed up to that treaty. And so it's actually creating this really interesting global divide where there's a lot of frustrations around nuclear disarmament, right? For listeners who don't know, the NPT, the whole reason countries without nuclear weapons signed up to that treaty and acquired and agreed to never build nuclear weapons, they were motivated by essentially what was what's sometimes described as the grand bargain, which is this idea that the five nuclear possessor countries under that treaty, the U.S., China, Russia, France, and the United Kingdom, would agree to work towards disarmament, towards a world without nuclear weapons over time. In exchange, the other countries that sign up agree to never build their own nuclear weapons and receive access to nuclear technology for peaceful uses. And so that grand bargain is under more tension today because, you know, we just talked about China's building up, the U.S. might counter-react, all of the nuclear possessors under the NPT are determined to hang on to their nuclear weapons. They value them more now than they did two decades ago in the 1990s, right? And so that is leading to, I think, a very, you know, various sources of strain. I mean, I will say about, you know, Central Asian countries and Pacific Island countries, they're certainly more concerned about these geopolitical dynamics. The Pacific Islands, for instance, in September last year, China launched an ICBM into the Pacific for the first time in 40 plus years. And I think that was viewed as a very negative event by the Pacific Island Forum and many of the countries in the region. So these dangers are going to manifest, I think, despite the wishes of, I think, many of these countries to see a world where nuclear weapons are pushed back into the background and ideally are pushed into, you know, the dustbin of history as we move towards disarmament. That is unfortunately not the world we're heading towards now.
All right. Well, maybe we can end on a more optimistic note. I'm curious on your thoughts on what next, where can the world go from this particular precipice? It certainly feels like one.
Yeah. So, you know, the thing I keep saying is that there's no shortage of good ideas about limiting nuclear arsenals, verifying certain types of military postures or capabilities that are or aren't deployed, for instance. The technical stuff is there. Lots of new opportunities with new technologies, even for arms control verification. The problem is primarily political today. It's because the geopolitical moment is so precarious, and you know you have a generation of leaders who I don't think have that experience that led kind of Kennedy and Khrushchev after the Cuban Missile Crisis to be terrified about how close they came to the precipice and then to turn towards arms control, compartmentalizing essentially nuclear dangers from the many other disagreements they have, right? It wasn't that arms control ended the Cold War. It was that arms control bounded the dangers that were otherwise, as the Cuban Missile Crisis showed, extremely likely to lead not just the United States and the Soviet Union, but humanity to the brink and beyond potentially. So today we don't have that. The U.S. and China have no arms control process between them to speak of, despite a rather minor agreement between the Biden administration and the Chinese government last November on making sure that artificial intelligence doesn't launch nuclear weapons, which is great, but kind of low-hanging fruit, right? But so the book has, thoughts about how we get back to that world. Like, what would it take to get back to a place where we can do arms control again? I think the nuclear testing issue is really important. There's rumblings in the U.S. and Russia and China, where all these countries are keeping their nuclear test sites in a fairly high level of readiness, that we could once again see a world where nuclear testing is normalized, right? Nuclear testing has only been carried out by one country in the 21st century, and that's North Korea. And so even having this conservative mindset, I think, is rather important, right? Conserving what we have built, preventing things from getting even worse, because I think nuclear testing would add to the arms racing pressures that these countries would face. And then, I finalized this, I finalized the manuscript for this book before November 2024. And so one of the things I argued in the book was that, political courage and prudent political leadership actually matter quite a bit. I would argue that looking at the major powers today, we don't really have good examples of that. But my hope is that as you said, my hope is that people will read the book, but I don't think you really need to even read the book to recognize that nuclear weapons are, of course, relevant in a way that they haven't been in a few decades. And so over time, I think as publics, as even strategic elites and governments become more concerned about these issues, which, they don't need to read the book, but they should read the book, in my opinion. The hope is that, that will lead us to a place where that political, those political circumstances that need to manifest to allow for the reduction of these risks can take hold. So I'll close it out there, Katie, but I really appreciated the chance to chat. It's fun to talk a bit about, I guess, my own work on the podcast for once.
Well, wonderful. I will say what Ankit very demurely would not, which is you should go read the book. Reminder, the title is The New Nuclear Age at the Precipice of Armageddon. You should be able to get it from wherever it is you get books. And please do read it, buy it for your friends. Have
Yeah.
a good time talking about nuclear weapons.
Thank you. The one thing I will say is if anybody's listening and is a Korean speaker, the book will be translated into Korean, which I'm very happy about. It's not yet out in Korean, but that will be available later in the summer. Katie, before we close out the podcast, though, I wanted to actually turn it over to you to talk a little bit about the upcoming issue of The Diplomat's Magazine, which I know you're very excited about. So do you want to tell our listeners what they can expect?
Yes, absolutely. Just a quick plug. The Diplomat's Next Magazine will be releasing next week, beginning of May. It will be our 126th issue. And on the cover, we mark the fall of Saigon, which happened in April 30th, 1975, with an article written by Nayan Chanda, who was a very young journalist at the time of the fall of Saigon. He was in Saigon when it fell. And he's the perfect person, really, to reflect on that momentous event. And more importantly, the dynamics at play, particularly between Vietnam and China and the United States in the 50 years since. So I really encourage you to check it out. We have other really great pieces in the issue, focusing on the AI race between the US and China, and also on the status of coal in Asia and much, much, much more, a lot on the trade war. But yeah, please check it out. We would enjoy having you as readers.
Fantastic. And so with that, I'll say if you like what you heard on the podcast, make sure you subscribe to listen to upcoming episodes. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, but you haven't yet reviewed the show, please do that as well. We really appreciate it. Helps us grow the show. And as always, if you have suggestions for content, reach out to either myself or Katie. Thanks a lot, and we'll be back soon with more.